Good evening, and welcome to our meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and our program, Latino, Latina, and the environment, Culture, Heritage, and Conservation. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environmental and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This program tonight is co-sponsored by the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum Chair Kevin O'Malley and an International Relations Member-Led Forum, Norma Walden, and Norma is here with us tonight. Our program will start in a few minutes. As you've heard from Patty, we really welcome you, welcome our new members, and welcome our members who come and are already members. So if you've not yet become a member, be sure and look at the member brochure because there are memberships for students, and then there are memberships for seniors like me. So there are a variety of memberships that you can do, and we would really like for you to become a member of the club. One of the advantages that I really like is that the club does a magazine every 2 months, and it's a great magazine, and I learn as much from the magazine sometimes as I do from the programs. So please join the Commonwealth Club. We are at www.commonwealthclub.org. Our fall upcoming programs in our environmental series includes on October 29th, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril with Francis Banyaki and Bob Deans, and is co-sponsored by the National Resources Defense Council. On September 18th, Progress and Hope, Restoring the Mighty Colorado River and Delta, An Inspiring Update. This program is co-sponsored by the Redford Center. And on November 20th, just in time for the holidays, a toast to the wine harvest, sustainable practices and California wine. And this program is co-sponsored by the Wine Institute, and I will give you a little plug. There will be wine tasting at this event. So look for our programs on web at www.commonwealthclub and on our green sheet, which is there for you to see. And I see lots of people have them. They are indeed green sheets. And hold on to that and come back to join us again for our meetings. Some reminders for tonight. Our program is timed for 1 hour for a possible radio broadcast. Please make sure that all cell phones, PDAs, and other noise-making devices are turned off. We will have questions from the audience today using the microphone. Please remember to speak directly into the microphone. And I actually forget to do that, so I am very cautious and careful about reminding you to be able to speak into the microphone so we get your questions on the audio tape. We pause now for 1 moment and then begin the program for our radio, television, and internet audiences. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program tonight is co-sponsored by the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair, and the International Relations Forum, Norma Walden, chair. Our program tonight is Latino, Latina, and the Environment, Culture, Heritage, and Conservation. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel member, Adriana Quintara, who is going to introduce you to our panel. Adriana?
Thank you very much, Anne. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. It's great to see all of you, and I'm really excited to have this conversation today with you all and with our very distinguished panelists here. I'm going to give all of them an opportunity to tell you who they are. Truly, some of the greatest minds in Latino engagement on environment. So We're going to hopefully have a really exciting, engaged discussion, leave some time for questions for you all, and hopefully we'll all walk out of here knowing a little bit more about why this important constituency plays such a critical role in helping us here in California and nationwide achieve our goals for environmental protection. I'd like to start by asking Gary Segura to introduce himself. He's a PhD and co-founder of Latino Decisions and a professor at Stanford University. Gary, welcome.
I'm glad to be here, and on behalf of my partner Sylvia Manzano and Matt Barreto on Latino Decisions, we were very privileged to be able to conduct a study that Adriana commissioned on behalf of the NRDC looking at Latino attitudes on the environment. We're going to tell you a bit more about that tonight.
Anita, would you like to introduce yourself? Anita Martinez?
Yes, I'm Anita Martinez, and I'm a retired educator. I work here at City College as both an instructor in ESL and as a dean, as a faculty member, activist who is both president of my union, president of my academic senate. I also worked at College of Marin as vice president of student services and instruction, and at Skyline College as the dean of language arts. So my interaction was primarily with students.
Which is a very important constituency, especially with the millennials and Latinos, and how many Latinos are turning 18 every month. We'll talk a little bit about that. Jose Gonzalez with Latino Outdoors.
Hello, everyone. Buenas noches. My name is Jose Gonzalez. I'm the founder of Latino Outdoors. My background is in education. I'm also an illustrator and conservationist. So what we're doing is really working to build a community and do the storytelling about what does it mean to have a Latino identity in relation to the outdoors.
Thanks, Jose. And Lisa Hoyos, who is the executive director and founder of Climate Parents.
Hi, good evening, everyone. My name is Lisa Hoyos, and I'm the co-founder and director of an organization, as Adriana said, called Climate Parents, that's focused on mobilizing parents and families for clean energy and climate solutions. And my background is predominantly in organizing and campaign work in the labor movement and the environmental justice movement.
Thank you, Lisa. And again, I don't think I introduced myself. I'm Adriana Quintero, and I am a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council here in NRDC and the director of Latino Outreach at NRDC. In our work on environment, I think in all of our work and in all of our lives, we know that there's strength in numbers. And what we've seen, especially here in California, is how the population has been changing. But what we often don't realize, and what I know has been really important for us and for all of us here, is to start to realize that there's truly strength behind having Latino engagement on issues like environment. It's not the obvious issue that comes to mind when we think of the Latino community. We think of immigration, we think of jobs, we think of economic justice, but we don't often think of environment. I'd like to turn it over to Gary so that, Gary, you have done an extensive amount of research, not only for NRDC, but for other organizations. Could you tell us a little bit about the demographics and exactly how important are these issues to Latinos and why?
First of all, thank you. I'm really excited to talk about that, and I need to credit my colleague Adrián Pantoja, who is a senior analyst for Latino Decisions, who actually managed the study with Adriana and is responsible for most of the findings I report tonight. I first began studying the environment and environmental attitudes among Latinos more than a decade ago and wrote what is still one of the few pieces ever written in political science about Latino attitudes on the environment, and was stunned to find that environmentalism was not a white phenomenon. It turns out that lots of people have very real and meaningful concerns about what it means to live in a planet where the ecosystem is being degraded on an almost momentary basis. So we wanted to do a study of Latino attitudes on climate change. This was a detailed study for the NRDC. Sort of giving you the top points, Latinos want government action on climate change. There are specific proposals that Latinos are willing to support. Climate is becoming a politically motivating issue. You will not hear much about that in the news, but Latinos do respond to climate appeals. And we have some arguments about why Latinos are such strong supporters of clean air and protecting the environment, and I'll lay some of those out for you. So how important is it for government to address global warming and climate change? Over 90% of Latino registered voters said it was somewhat or very important, or extremely important, rather, for the government to do something about it. And this is not a number that you would have necessarily expected if the argument is that Latinos aren't paying attention to these sorts of issues. Over half of all Latinos are very concerned specifically about climate change. 55% said that they were extremely or very concerned about the phenomenon of climate change. That's a level of salience that's really quite surprising. In some results I'm not going to present here, Latinos were about as energized about the climate as they were about immigration, and they were more energized about climate than they were about things like jobs. So it was really quite astounding. We asked some specific policy proposals to ask whether the Latino registered voters would be willing to support them. Large majorities of Latino registered voters are supportive of government-backed actions to fight carbon pollution and climate change. 92% are in favor of better gas mileage standards. 92% want increased use of solar and wind. 87% want to limit power plant pollution. 94% wanted higher home efficiency standards. And 91% wanted greater investment in sort of protecting homes from weather, which of course is a big burn of energy. Latinos do want government. They want strong government action to do this. This is not a case where people are willing to rely primarily on the free market. They do, in fact, believe that some form of government mandate is necessary. Now, the question about this is always whether or not this is politically palatable. That is, will Latinos be able to pay the costs necessary associated with this, and will they be able to communicate their interest to people running for office? And will those people in office be risking things by taking action? 80%, 4 of 5 Latino registered voters, want the president to take unilateral action on climate change if Congress will not. To give you a relevant reference, that's about the same level of support for the Deferred Action Program in immigration. So there's overwhelming enthusiasm for the president acting to protect the environment from the crisis of global warming.
Gary, not to interrupt you, but just for those of in the audience who might not know, so when you said undeferred action, is that the same thing as the DREAM Act?
Well, the DREAM Act was never passed legislatively. This was the president's effort to implement it by simply protecting those DREAM-eligible young people from deportation, which he did in June of 2012. Wildly popular, but oddly no more popular than taking unilateral action on climate protection.
That's very impressive.
And my guess is that most of you would not have necessarily anticipated that before tonight. In terms of voicing more support for limitations of carbon emissions, our findings are that somewhere in the neighborhood of 80% of Latinos, almost 80%, would think more favorably of members of Congress if they took action to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Now, one of the big problems with this sort of analysis is that frequently people are willing to support all of these things to protect the environment, but when you put a price tag on them, then all of a sudden they're less excited about that. Well, we put a price tag on them. So would you be willing to pay more on your monthly electric bill for cleaner energy to reduce carbon pollution? Now, 20% of our respondents said that they wouldn't pay anything. So there were 20%, but remember, 80% were enthused, so that's the other 20%. But 18% were willing to pay $1. Almost 40% were willing to pay $5 to $10 a month to increase their electric bill in order to reduce greenhouse gas emission. 15% were willing to pay twice that, $15 or more. And 10% said that they would pay something, but they weren't sure what the breakpoint was. Now, what's key about this is that 52% of our respondents are, in fact, willing to pay meaningful increases in their electricity bills in order to reduce the impact on the environment that electric generation has. Of course, that means that it could generate as much as $575 million per month, or $6.9 billion a year in terms of money to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
That's amazing.
Now, finally, the last thing I'm going to say is that people think about this from lots of different perspectives. 65% of our respondents said they think about the issue of climate from a global perspective. 14% said family, 10% country, 5% community. It is very much global thinking. Now, that's not surprising given the large amount of foreign-born persons in the U.S. Latino population. And so we asked them, how worried are you that environmental problems may affect family living in Latin America? 33% said very worried. Another 30% said somewhat worried. So Latinos think globally about the environment because they're global citizens. They have family and friends across international boundaries. So support for these sorts of actions is very widespread. And I'll show you here that strong majorities on that question of asking the president to act unilaterally. Foreign-born, 84%. U.S.-born, first-generation U.S.-born, 81%. U.S.-born to U.S.-born parents, 82%. Mexicans, 83%. Puerto Ricans, 87%. The Cubans are a little less. No surprise there. But what we're showing you is that there's lots of people who are willing to support these actions across different divisions. Even a majority of self-identified Republicans favor the president taking unilateral action, and supermajorities of the very poor and the very rich support the president taking unilateral action to reduce global warming. And with that, I'll turn it over to the rest of the panel.
This is truly diverse, and I think that when we think of diverse support, that's what we want to see. We want to see that it crosses party lines, that it goes from the poorest to the wealthiest, the least educated to the most educated. And I always have to ask myself, and I wonder if our panelists could share a little bit of insight as to why this is. We know that we've seen from the results, and we know from some of our experience that Latinos are global citizens, and we have a global perspective. But there's something more there. There is something cultural or in the way that we view our place in the world that influences this. And I wonder if one of the things that we found here as well is that we have different things that lead us to these issues. It could be our home experience, it could be our experience in another country or such, or it could be as simple as our experiences in our communities. Jose, could you tell us a little bit? I know that you've worked a lot with students and with people getting Latinos outdoors. What have you found as far as culture and heritage, since that is something that we're talking about here today?
Yeah, of course. You know, when we look at the numbers and the data, they're so crucial and important because it is, as we say, the facts. You know, they show us. This is, you know, people will respond. And so what does that look like in the communities? What does that look like on the ground? What are the stories that resonate and complement this data? We're seeing that, I mean, one of the things is that this is not new. It's not like Latinos stumbled onto caring about the environment now. It's really the other way around. It's who's paying attention. Because there's a long history and tradition in the U.S. and in the countries, the home countries from where families are coming from. This comes from a very personal experience. I'm an immigrant to the U.S. from Mexico. So I grew up as an immigrant in this country, but I didn't discover the environment in the U.S. I came with it from a personal experience with my grandfather, with my family in Mexico. What I was able to do is the connective tissue. What does conservation look like in the U.S., and how are we informing that work and movement? So if I didn't have sequoias back in Mexico, how is it that they resonate with me here as protected lands? And so we're finding that when we're taking families that are first generation immigrants, they might be farm workers, it may be a new space, but it's not a new idea in concept. And it's rooted in work that comes maybe called traditional Latino values of family, certain familial respect, faith. There's a lot of community orientation, and especially when it comes to issues that affect the family in terms of health, in terms of appreciation. But also, again, the last key thing here is Latino, by definition, is a challenging, you know, it's a hard identity. But what is a connective tissue there? Is what I refer to, you know, we're multicultural in a lot of identity. So I like to use the term ambicultural just as bicultural. So that by definition, a lot of Latino families are mestizo, you're mixed. So you have a lot of different roots, and all of those different roots play a role in how the environment has been accepted since, you know, from indigenous roots to what it means about growing up with the land. What does it mean when we ask Chicano youth and they understand I need to be in touch with Tonantzin? When we ask grandparents and they're like, mijo, we have to take care of, you know, lo que nos dio Dios, right? To when we have second, third generation conservationists that are like, you know, I value John Muir just as I'm down for Emiliano Zapata, right? That's what we mean about being ambicultural. You mix it together and you leverage it that way.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Latino and the Environment, Culture, Heritage, and Conservation.
Thanks, Jose, for that. I think one of the things that we've heard from the Park Service and such is that actually Latinos use the national parks in large numbers, but the use is slightly different than what we see in traditional environmentalists. And I think that that goes to one of the points that Gary, you made. The environment is not a white issue. So then why is it that we don't often associate Latinos with environment? Could it be in your experience, Anita, in the way that we're speaking to students and the way that we're communicating on these issues?
Well, yes, and it is changing, and it is changing in this way. There's a rising tide in colleges, especially the community colleges, to require as a graduation requirement not just competence in English, and competence in math, and competence in critical thinking, but also competence in eco-literacy. It's just at the beginning stages. But the problem is that this push for this to be a graduation requirement must come from the faculty themselves, because the faculty control the curriculum, they propose it, and then it is approved by someone else, but it has to come from the faculty. So faculty are beginning to organize themselves to have this push, and I would predict that within the next 10 to 25 years, that eco-literacy requirement will become a reality. It's just at the talking stages, but I think it will come. And I do know the other thing that happens is that teachers who are anxious for it to happen incorporate teachings about the environment into their classes. I, as an ESL teacher, and I and my colleagues would often have units within our courses about the environment, which would spark discussion, and there was animation among all the students from all over the world and much interest in the importance of preserving the environment for their families and the future generations.
Well, that's very interesting, and I think it's something that we've found as well in our work at NRDC and through Voces Verdes, is that it's really about speaking in different languages, and not even if we're all speaking in English, it's about letting people come to this issue from their own perspective. Whether you're a recent immigrant or you've been here for numerous generations, it's really being able to widen the umbrella on environmentalism beyond the John Muir model of the lone hiker on the mountain to perhaps enjoying the national parks with 20 of your closest relatives, having a nice, you know, bucket of chicken and listening to some salsa. And there's no wrong or right way to appreciate the outdoors. And there's also no wrong or right way to come to this issue. And that's one of the things that I think, Lisa, I'd like you to talk a little bit about, because in your work with parents and in your previous work with labor, I think you've been very exposed and been very active in being able to communicate to people and finding them where they are in bringing them into the issue of climate change and environmental protection generally. Can you tell us a little bit about how your experience with that?
Sure. Actually, very early in my grassroots organizing career, I worked on a project in the Central Valley of California in Kettleman City to try to stop a hazardous waste incinerator from being put in a largely Latino migrant farm worker community. And one thing I noted there is just sort of a culture of activism, a culture of caring, a culture of families coming together. This was like 90% Latino, this town in Kettleman City. And just clarity around, there was an organization there called People for Clean Air and Water, And it's about clean air and water. Our kids are going to have asthma. They already had the largest class one has waste dump in Kettleman City, and a big company wanted to build an incinerator right on top of it. I think it's similar when you look at climate impacts and who gets hurt first and worst. It's low income, typically communities of color. A lot of communities are Latino. And I think you blend the impacts with sort of a tradition of struggle, lucha, justice, and you have the makings of a potential social movement. And one of the leaders in the recent climate march in New York City that drew 400,000 people, and it was led by frontline communities, was Eddie Bautista, who's a major New York-based Puerto Ricano environmental leader. So I think just a lot of what you were saying, Adriana, and what you were saying, Jose, about cultural heritage and what values we hold dear in the Latino community lend themselves well to caring about climate, what Gary said about a global perspective on climate.
So how did it differ, however, in, for example, how you speak, and just this, I'm going to stick with you for a second, Lisa, how you would speak right now to parents about climate change versus to the labor movement or to workers about climate?
Sure. So in the work of climate parents, we focus a lot on what is it about being a parent that makes you care about this issue. And just quickly on my story, I mean, again, a long background as an organizer, but I heard this NPR story once about what the world might look like in 2035 if we didn't do anything to really address climate change. And they talked about food shortages, food scarcity, water scarcity. And this was in 2008. And it was during the presidential run, you know, of Obama. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, people talk about soccer moms. They talk about hockey moms. What about climate moms? What about climate parents? Because we love our kids more than life itself. And this is, like, a clear and present danger. I mean, there was a Pentagon report last week saying what a big danger it is globally. And so I think parents relate to the climate issue out of concern for what the world's going to look like for our kids. But I think it's really important, the psychology of it, and I think it also links to labor, to pivot quickly towards solutions. No one really wants to really dwell in how bad things can get. It's like, what do we do about it? And that's where some of the political questions that Gary was getting at are really important, that the large majority of Latinos want unilateral action by this president on climate change. So I think that's all about solutions. He's pushing for a clean power plan. That'll bring renewables and help scale renewables. And so for parents, in terms of just keeping that hope place alive and central, it's about really pivoting toward clean energy, solar, messages like we can get to 100% clean energy by 2050 in California by 2030 if we make the right investments and exercise our right political muscles, left political muscles.
So what I'm hearing, I think, from everyone, I'm going to go back to you, Gary, is a lot of optimism, not only for this issue per se, but specifically if we look at the ability of Latinos to get involved here. However, if you look at the community generally, we have some challenges as far as jobs, we have challenges as far as healthcare, we have challenges as Latinos as far as economic well-being. How does, in your study, how does this sense of optimism, of looking towards a better future, how could we translate that into political action? And we don't have to, you don't have to stick to this issue per se, but in your experience, you've polled on a number of Latino issues. How does this, and Lisa hinted at it, and Jose did as well, this ability to kind of just activate our community, how can we turn that into political action?
I don't think I have necessarily the silver bullet solution, but I'm actually way more optimistic than most people that I talk to about this. And the reason I'm optimistic about this is there's several different reasons. The first is that, you know, for a living I study political mobilization, and everyone wants to talk about how few Latinos vote. And when I look at the income distribution, the education distribution, and the median age, when I compare a Latino and a non-Hispanic white person of exactly the same circumstances, Latinos are actually more likely to vote. And so what we need to do is improve the educational opportunities for Latino children and move a larger and larger share of Latinos into the middle class. Age will come all by itself. And as a consequence, the Latino community will become more empowered over time. The other thing I'd say is, and you mentioned the 18-year-old thing, 73,000, everyone loves this number, and
yes.
I do too, 73,000 Latino citizens of the United States turn 18 and enter the eligible electorate every month.
That's amazing.
73,000 a month. And the young people that I interact with from across all levels of acculturation, all levels of income, are really some of the most dynamic and energized people that I meet in the Latino community. And if you've had any interaction with the Dream Kids, who are unbelievably courageous and unbelievably fearless and willing to speak truth to power, I'm actually very optimistic.
There you go. I agree with you, Gary, and I think that we all are. We probably wouldn't be doing this. But and that is truly a stunning number. I'm just going to repeat it because I'm one of those people who loves that number. 73,000 Latino citizens of the United States, I love how you put it, I'm going to quote you on that one, become eligible to vote each month. That is incredibly powerful, and that's a really amazing, untapped force of nature that this country, that we have the potential to mobilize. And I guess that we all have that question of how do we do that? How do we motivate people? How do we make sure that this is a kitchen table issue? And I'd like to hear from you, Jose, because we are talking about younger people. We are talking about students here. And I think there is a different model of engagement when we're looking at younger people. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences and your perspective on that?
Definitely. I mean, there's a reason the phrase "si se puede" resonates, right? And a lot of these phrases in Spanish, there's a reason they resonate a little deeply. When we compare how we say Mother Earth in English to Madre Tierra in Español, you feel the roots kind of resonate a little more. And even just within Latino Outdoors, you know, who are we finding that really want to step up and help us in this work? It's college students. It's the millennials. It's those that say, I want to do something. I like what you are saying and sharing, and I want to be a part of it. The question is the how. It's like, we said, sí se puede, pero hazlo. So how do we do it? So the big thing is just essentially to have that platform and be able to say, I need your help, let's show each other how to do this. Because when you really open it up so that the youth can show you, you know, what they're doing and what they're interested in, and you're supporting that instead of trying to be prescriptive about it, it's just amazing. And so that's where my optimism comes from as well. And when we connect it to the parents, is so that the parents can see, because especially when we have parents who migrate to this country, say we want better opportunities for our kids. So when we can show them that the environment is one of those opportunities, that's another connective tissue where all of a sudden what we're really doing is we're making those linkages work. Because again, we're activating what we call like the social infrastructure. There are relationships and connections that already exist. What we're just being able to do is like, you want a better outlook for your family and your kids, they can be an ecologist and do this work. You know, they can be doing work in these fields. And so what we're finding is that those pathways really resonate for the youth, and it really resonates for the family.
I really love how you put it. Let them show us. Like, let us show you, if I was the young person. Mm-hmm. That's critical. And I think that in my experience, that has not been the way that we've approached environmentalism generally, whether we're talking about it with Anglo-English speaker or Latinos. And I think that's really important. It's you tell me what this means to you rather than prescriptively and prescribing this is what we think you should be talking about and what you should be saying. So listening is at the core of that. And not fearing giving that microphone to the young person who may not have all of the scientific terminology just right, but who definitely has the spirit and the heart there to make it happen. Anita, along those lines, one of the things that we should do and can be doing, however, is providing better opportunities for education in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. In your experience in the system, in the education system, are we doing a good enough job on that front?
I don't think so, not yet. But I tend to be a little bit optimistic about it because I've seen how things have changed from what they were before. When I was in college, young women were not helped to be interested in science at all. In fact, they were actively discouraged, and women of my generation know that to be true. I may have wanted to major in biology, but I was actively discouraged. I may have wanted to go into medicine, but I was actively discouraged. So what I and my student generation did in the 1960s is we shut down our institutions of higher learning, in particular San Francisco State. We shut it down to increase access and support, economic support for students who wanted to go to school.
There's activism and right there.
That's activism right there. And then what happened is a generation later, and it's within my own family, my older daughter went to medical school and graduated and is now serving the community in that way. And she and many others credit the activist students of the late 60s for knocking down the doors so that they could walk through them. And now in medical schools, you see 50% of the medical school classes being women, and more of the students being Latinos and Latinas. And so that's important. The whole idea is to support and not get upset with the young folks when they take these ideas and the energy and they mobilize. What they need help with is in the experience of how that we have and how to do the organizing.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Latino and the Environment, Culture, Heritage, and Conservation.
Thank you, Anita. I think that that's really important, and we all know that we need to do a better job educating our students. And again, I think what the constant theme we're hearing here is we need to let people and students specifically drive this and take us to the next level. Gary, you're also an educator, and in addition to being a researcher, you interact with a lot of students. Putting those two pieces together, how well are we doing on communicating data? Because that's something that's also hard for people to absorb, but we need to know the facts. And while we can talk about simple facts, why people care, when we talk about numbers, people get a little bit more confused. Is there any way that if we were to let's say, take this home, and our listeners were to try and take this home to their families, a simple way of really driving the point home that we saw in your presentation, that 90% of Latinos care about this, and or do we really need to focus on the percentages and getting that right? I think we, as a country, kind of get caught up in that discussion, and that seems to turn people off.
The percentages, the numbers, the bar charts are really important on cable news, and they're also really important in the halls of Congress. When we're trying to persuade friendly members to act when they're reluctant to act, and hostile members to not act when they're absolutely willing to act. We use these numbers and they can be really important. But I'm not sure that they're particularly helpful in the grassroots. I think from the grassroots perspective, it's important to humanize the reality of what the environment means. Now, the bad news is that Latinos have been more adversely impacted by some of the environmental change than many other communities. Many Mexican migrants to the United States come here because of the very bitter, long drought in the breadbasket regions of Mexico, which have just absolutely destroyed the corn economy, and that combined with some political and financial changes. So they know what it's like to see environmental degradation. And the other is that since the late 1990s, the Mothers of East LA started working on suspended particulate pollution near the Port of Los Angeles in San Pedro because diesel smoke causes higher rates of asthma in African American and Latino children than we see in any other populations. So you don't need to talk about bar charts. All you need to talk about is the number of kids in your elementary school that have asthma, or the number of families you know that left their land in Michoacan or left their land in Zacatecas because it wasn't farmable anymore.
Well, and you pointed to something really important there. The respiratory impacts, there's probably nothing that really hits home more than when you have bronchitis or asthma or some type of lung inflammatory condition where you can barely breathe, and it's only made worse because it's hot outside and there are trucks driving by your window day and night. We're seeing these impacts. We're seeing the impacts here in California of an extended drought, and much of what you're talking about that already happened in Mexico, we're now living here. And we are facing a crisis. We're seeing sea level rise in a lot of places. So we're seeing the impacts that are climate change. And that does seem to drive the point home for people. Fortunately, right now, we're at a position where we're also seeing, as Lisa, you pointed out, an opportunity to take action with the president's climate plan. That's something that oftentimes when we talk about it, people get a little bit distracted. They don't understand what it means. They're not sure how that's going to help. Obviously, we know that people want the president to take action. We know that Latinos want the president to take action. But how do you think, Lisa, that we could better communicate that fact, the fact that, yes, here we're humanizing the problem, but we're also going to present a solution, and we're going to do that in the simplest form. Can you give us an example of how you've talked to parents about the president's climate plan and how our listeners might talk to their children and their parents and friends and family?
Sure. Actually, just this morning, Climate Parents, my organization, worked with some of our members in Florida to do an event with Congressman Joe Garcia, and he talked. He just shared a simple message to the press that was there, which was simply, he has kids, he has a granddaughter, and he is really concerned that the South Florida he grew up in and loves and enjoys is going to look really, really different for her because of sea level rise and storm surges and all of those things. And such a simple message. It's like, we have to act. And then, boom, he goes into his couple of plans for how to act. I mean, for example, Florida has more solar potential than any state in the U.S. and yet has one of the least amounts of solar installation. And so there's all this room for growth and investment. And I think something we're not doing so much yet, but I'd like to do, and I love being on these panels where you get to meet really cool, smart people, because then you can meet afterwards and think of ideas, but is think about how we make these solutions more accessible to Latinos and other low-income populations. I mean, obviously, Latinos are multi-class, but in terms of who would need support, for example, to get a solar lease, what's the plan for renters, for example? So now, through companies like Sungevity, you might have heard of, SolarCity, there's leasing. Instead of, you don't have to go out and buy expensive panels, you could lease them and your energy bill goes down right away. However, what if you rent? And so some of those kind of clean energy solutions that I think would really help, when you have a population that wants to act so badly, what are the barriers to entry and how do we overcome those? And that's something, as a climate parent, I want to think about improving upon. So we'll meet after this panel's over.
Right. We heard from Gary that the community is even willing to pay for this, but oftentimes they don't even know what that means. What do I have to go buy? What do I have to pay for? How do I get it? And how do I make sure that the barriers aren't there? Because in a place like Florida, you could have all the money in the world, but you still can't access it because of the way that they have been making sure that we remain dependent on fossil fuels. I know we're nearing our question time, Anne.
Right. And this is Anne Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Latinos and the Environment. And it is time for our questions from the audience. So what I'm going to do is start in the back and come forward, and remember, please, to speak into the microphone so we will be sure that you're recorded. So let me start from the back and work forward. If you will raise your hand, who would have a question now for our panel?
Hi. I have questions for each one of the panelists and your organizations. There are a number of environmental education, not environmental education, but environmental groups and Latino groups existing already. My question is, how are you partnering with the groups that exist already, such as Literacy for Environmental Justice, Wild Equity? And then how are you reaching out to Latino organizations that may have a little bit of a different focus, such as social advocacy and or professional orientation, such as the Chicana Latina Foundation or SHIP, or even a group like Homeboy Inc., which is down in LA, and cross-pollinating your message with theirs and partnering?
That's an excellent question. Thank you for that. And I think that we all have something to add. I know that we've all had different experiences with different partnerships, but that's where the strength is, in partnerships. I know that in our work at Voces, we've specifically worked with Latino leaders, with business leaders, with health professionals and educators as well. And that's simply because we had not had the capacity to go to the grassroots level, but it's worked out wonderfully because there's so much leadership there and there's so much innovation that's going unnoticed. And for us, it's really important to be able to elevate that. Homeboy Industries is an incredible success story and one that everybody should know about. We need to do a better job at amplifying those stories so that we can show that the Latino leadership exists, and that way our young people will feel more motivated to carry that torch. But I will let the other panelists as well add to this. I know there are so many wonderful environmental justice groups, social justice groups, housing groups, a number of folks who work in this issue and have done so for many years. Jose, do you want to start?
Yeah, great question. And you know, we could go on the whole day just on that. Real quickly, I would give a shout out to my colega Marce from Azul
yes.
Project, who's in the audience.
Yes.
And I mean, that's a great example of knowing that we work through community. I mean, just success story right now, so many. The plastic bag ban.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
huge.
That's a success story right there. And that showed the Latino leadership across the board that this isn't just about let's take care of the plastic bags for one issue, it's across many issues. And that means a lot of different Latino-led and Latino-supported groups, as well as conservation groups, needed to see what does it mean to actually work together and listen to each other, which can be very difficult, especially from the conservation side. So even in my experience, you know, Latino Outdoors is meant to support others and to support other work, because if we're doing it alone, then we're not doing it right. So to give you an example, I know all the organizations you mentioned, and so what we're doing is we're looking at how environmental justice as a frame is one way to work at it, but also how we make sure that we can provide opportunities to Latino-serving organizations that may just lack the capacity or resources. So to give one quick example, we had a conservation organization here in the Bay Area, in the North Bay, Marin County, and they asked, we want to be able to take the Latino community, you know, the broad question, Latino community out into these outdoor spaces. And they said, but we're having difficulty trying to connect. Like, we can pay for a bus if need be. And so they called me, and I said, well, let's go and let's find out where the community is. And that's a way we were able to bring different Latino-serving groups, like the Canal Alliance, for example, E3. They're interested in this. But they have so many other things going on, we just need to be able to support to do that. And that's one simple way that we could take out from kids all the way to elders out to Drake's Beach. Some of them had never been there. And as you know, I mean, that's in Marin County from San Rafael. It's not that far away. But that's how you need to work together to make that happen.
Great, Jose. Yeah, Anita, I saw you shaking your head quite a bit to all of these. Do you want to add? I know that you have a long history of activism and probably know a lot of the same groups.
Yes, but it's very often it's person to person. It's making connection with one person within an organization, networking the same way you do, that individuals do for individual benefit, but in this case, for a common cause of the environment. I also think it's important to network not just among the community, but with people who are employed by agencies that can impact our community. The National Park Service is one, to see if you know somebody who works in the Park Service who can do something to encourage our young people to go out, such as biodiversity days, bio blitzes, those kind of things that have happened in the Bay Area. That, in fact, I became more aware of through the work of my daughter with the National Park Service as a National Park Service employee at Joshua Tree. And when you have those individuals, you have to make those connections because then they can bring something to the table that sometimes organizations, community-focused organizations, cannot bring themselves.
That's great. Lisa, I know you wanted to add something.
Yeah, just to add sort of a concrete example, especially of partnerships not only between my organization, Climate Parents, with other EJ groups, environmental justice groups, but key partnerships the environmental justice organizations are forging with bigger environmental organizations. So concretely, when San Onofre, the nuclear power plant, closed, a group called the California Environmental Justice Alliance, CEJA, decided to join forces together with the Sierra Club. Most of the leaders, in fact, of the Sierra Club in Southern California who I've worked with on this campaign are Latino. And I think that's part of a conscious effort to diversify some of the big environmental groups too. But anyway, that partnership was really strong because they were pushing the California Public Utilities Commission to not build new gas plants, but instead invest in renewables. We all collectively didn't get in as far in that quest as we wished. However, we're continuing to try to block these new gas plants because, you know, guess where these new gas plants would be built? Like the Pio Pico plant, mostly in a Latino community. So there's great opportunities to do neighborhood-based organizing combined with sort of movement, environmental justice, structural organizing with trained organizers. Anita, you were talking about the importance of movement experience. People who are trained organizers in the trenches know how to move people. And then to make links with more resource organizations that realize that if they don't really think about integrating Latinos into the lifeblood of their organization, they're going to be left behind. And not only that, I think the environmental justice movement has done a good job in the last 20 years of pushing the envelope with the bigger environmental groups to help them really understand when we talk about environment and when we talk about community and we talk about who's most affected, how do we build the power of communities of color within our own leadership structures. And, you know, I think Adriana is a great example of that, who started Voces Verdes within the Natural Resources Defense Council, one of the largest and most respected environmental groups in the country.
Thanks, Lisa. Great question. Do we have any other questions?
We do. And actually, unfortunately, this will probably be one of our last questions. So here's the question.
Probably all of you have a better feel than most of us about the other countries in Central and South America. I wonder what your thoughts are on which ones are the environmental stars, which ones are the environmental villains.
Yeah. It would be wonderful to hear from each of the panelists on this question.
If I can, this is Anita Martinez. From personal experience, through travel there, my favorite is Costa Rica. Their deliberate move to build ecotourism as an economic base for them not only provided an exciting place for tourists like me to come, but it also provided jobs for people within the region, and it provided a real link to nature and people's survival in that regard.
This is Gary Segura. My sense is that that may not be a fair question, because there are nation states south of our border that do well, and there are nation states that do less well. But a great deal of the environmental decisions that are being made in Latin America are being made with an eye towards the U.S. market. So, for example, if there's deforestation in Brazil, that might be because tropical hardwoods are coming to the United States, and then the remaining land is being used to graze cattle so that beef consumption in the Western Hemisphere could go. So it's, I think we need to look at the system of economic relations that connect everything from the Hudson Bay to Tierra del Fuego, and understand that the Americas are a single monetary and economic unit, and environmental degradation or environmental success, whether it be in Central America or the Southern Cone or in Brazil or even in Canada, that those things are a product of those interrelationships.
Yeah, this is Jose Gonzalez. Actually, I was going to build on that, right? The old line, if the U.S. sneezes, it's Latin America that catches the cold. So I think that's what I was going to say. It's the question of, so what does it mean in terms of environmental star? So let's say we have preservation of the Amazon rainforest. What's the reason behind that? Or if it's habitat destruction, what's the reason behind that? Because a lot of that is the economic ties. And you see that not just in the environment, but how it's integrated in the other issues. So even with just immigration, it's not, again, it's the fact that if you cannot sustain the ecosystem you have at home, where do you go elsewhere to try to have a better outcome for your family? And I think where we're seeing the success is like in Mexico with the Sierra Gorda. It's when the communities are saying, we need to take that system back so it serves the community and not the economic interests of some other faraway places. So I think those are where I see the examples. Instead of saying like Mexico as a whole is fantastic or it's not doing great, we can point to examples within that about where, again, it's the same values. As a community, like Sierra Gorda, how are they showing what a bioregion can look like when it thrives, when it connects the environment and the community together? Instead of saying Amazon rainforest, preserve, kick out all the people, because that's the way that this is going to stay protected.
It's Lisa Hoyos. Just to twist the question just a tiny bit, you know, California is going to be majority Latino by when, Gary?
It's already plurality Latino.
Plurality, but when's it going to be? Yeah.
Yeah, majority, probably another 10 years.
Yeah, so rapidito. And our leadership, you can see in the state government here, is reflecting that. And I just feel like it's a little bit of a tale of two paths for Latinos. So on the one hand, you have Kevin De Leon, pro tem of the Senate, the leader of the Senate. Total leader on environmental justice. He's making sure that some of the revenues that come from our cap and trade program go to fund access to clean energy and energy efficiency in low-income communities. On the other side of that coin, there's a Latino leader from Fresno, Henry Perea, who took the lead in the last legislative session trying to stop fuels, which cause 40% of our greenhouse gases here in California from coming in under the cap. Who is bankrolling that or, you know, highly incentivizing that? The Western States Petroleum Association. But the narrative is important. The narrative is low-income people are going to get hit by rising gas prices. Latinos are going to get hit. That's one story to tell. The other story to tell is how do we grow clean energy, make it accessible, make it affordable, and reduce these horrific asthma rates that are the kids suffering in his own district. He has the most polluted zip code in the whole state, and yet he's kind of carrying the water of the Western States Petroleum Association with a lot more Latinos. There's a question really right now if AB 32, our Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, by Fabian Nunez, Latino, Fran Pavli, and Governor Schwarzenegger at the time, could that even pass today? And there's a real fair question. So I think it's on us, like gente with conciencia, you know, like, are we going to stand up for what those polling numbers said, which is Latinos want this, or are we going to kind of get a little bit caught up in our tough system of political finance where people really bow down too much to oil companies?
I think what you hint on there, and I know that we're running out of time, is that it's really about education. I mean, we know that too often we can't say blanketly all Latinos care. We can say the numbers show that they do. However, as you're pointing out here in California, we've got the tale of two Latinos who one is very pro-environment and others who are not. So I think that ultimately we do have to look beyond just the initial impression. And one of the things that I will say about the question that was raised internationally is we have seen a lot of Latino leadership. We've seen leadership in Mexico where they pass a climate act. We've seen leadership in fuels. We've seen leadership in conservation. And we're about to see probably some pretty significant action at the UN Conference of Parties in Lima at the end of this year. And that's going to be the time where countries are going to have to come together and deliver on some of the promises that they were called and questioned about at the People's Summit in New York just a few just a month ago. So the rubber's hitting the road, and right now we need to be the ones behind it, driving this, whether we're Latinos, African Americans, whites, it doesn't matter who we are, just really calling for action, because we're all breathing the same air, we're all living in this planet, and we're all going to suffer the cost and consequences of climate change. We have an opportunity to take action right now by acting on climate, looking at the hashtag ActOnClimate, going to the EPA's website, going to NRDC's website, or any of our organizations, Voces Verdes, and taking action, saying, I want this because I care about my future, and I know that we can do better. ultimately, I think that one of the motivators for us as Latinos is that we did come to this country with a dream, and we still have that dream. And we believe that the American dream can and should be attainable. So why should we settle for the fuels that our grandparents use? Why we wouldn't want to drive their cars or, heck, even use the cell phones that people in the 70s used. So why are we settling for polluting cars, for polluting power plants, when we can do so much better? We don't need to settle. We can get there. And I think that the youth of tomorrow and our Latino youth, those 75,000, is it, Gary? 73. So, okay, I'm increasing the number as we go. 73,000 a month. They still believe, and we can get this done.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to our program on Latinas and the Environment, Cultural Heritage, and Conservation. And unfortunately, we have come to that point when we have to go away with something I think is a wonderful message, and that is we have to dream, and we have to reach out to make sure that our dreams become reality. So I hadn't thought about it that way, Adriana, but that really is a wonderful way to look at what we've discussed tonight. And for myself personally, I'd like to share with you that I'm absolutely taken aback by the statistics that we have seen tonight and Gary's work. I think that is a wonderful piece of work that needs to get out far and wide, not only to the Latino community, but to all of our communities, because it's so important. So we will end tonight with a big thank you to our distinguished panel, Adriana Quintara, Gary Segura, Anita Martinez, Jose Gonzalez, and Linda Ojos. Is that right, Linda?
Am I?
Lisa.
Close. Sorry about that. So Lisa, and thank you again to all our panelists and all their work. And a big thank you to our audience here today and our radio and internet audiences. Our thanks also to Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership, the Member-Led Forum, and to Norma Walden, who's with us today, who is chair of the International Relations Member-Led Forum, for co-sponsoring this program. I'm especially grateful to them because they helped us get the word out about the program tonight and our ability to reach out to all of you. Look for all of the Commonwealth programs at www.commonwealthclub.org and check our radio, video, and free streaming podcasts. Remember, you can find our programs on radio, video, and podcasts, and watch programs on the California Channel Thursday at 9 p.m. and on KRCB-TV Channel 22 on Comcast, as well as DirecTV at 11 a.m. last Sunday of each month. Subscribe to our free podcasting service to automatically download a new program recording to your personal computer each week. To do this, go to commonwealthclub.org/podcast. Don't forget our green announcements and our fall 2014 New Visions for the Environment programs that are coming up. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 111 years of enlightened discussion. And I do remind my adult children that I have not been around for 111 years. In the know is adjourned. Thank you.